and years. The permanent silence of lives stopped, all the voices gone. "Not that I'm objecting," he said, "but is this first name thing going to be a habit?" "When I need it, yeah." Below him in the square, a group of boys appeared. The oldest of them couldn't have been more than 10. What were they doing out there? Then Peter grasped the situation. One of the boys had a ball. At the center of the square, he dropped it on the ground and kicked it, sending the rest scurrying after it. A pair of 5-tons pulled into the square. Soldiers disembarked and began to set up a line of tables. More were hauling out crates of weaponry and ammunition to be distributed among the civilian inductees. The boys took only cursory notice, lost in their game, which appeared to have nothing in the way of formal structure. No rules or boundaries, no objectives or way to keep score. Whoever possessed the ball tried to keep it away from the others, until he was bested by one of his companions, thus starting the mad chase all over again. Peter's thoughts took him back many years, first to the formless contests that had diverted Caleb and his friends for hours, and their contagious youthful energy. "Just 5 more minutes, Dad. There's still plenty of light. Please, just 1 more game? And then to his own boyhood, that brief, innocent span in which he had existed in total obliviousness, outside the flow of history and the accumulated weight of life. He turned from the window. "Do you remember the day Vicky summoned me to her office to offer me a job?" "Not really, no." "As I was leaving, she called me back, asked about Caleb, how old he was. She said, and I think I have this right, it's the children we're doing this for. We'll be long gone, but our decisions will determine the kind of world they're going to live in." Apgar gave a slow nod. "Come to think of it, maybe I do remember. She was a cunning old broad, I'll give her that. It was a masterpiece of manipulation. No chance I could turn her down. It was just a matter of time before I surrendered." "So what's your point?" "The point is, this patch of ground doesn't just belong to us, Gunner. It belongs to them. First Colony was dying. Everyone had given up. But not here. That's why Kerrville has survived as long as it has. Because the people here have refused to go quietly. We're talking about the survival of our species. I know we are. But we need to earn the right, and abandoning 3,000 people to save 700 isn't an equation I can sit with. So maybe it all ends here. Tonight, even. But this city is ours. This continent is ours. We run. Fanning wins, no matter what. And Vicky would say the same thing." A moment of stalemate passed, the two men looking at each other. Then, "That's a nice speech," Apgar said.
"Yeah, I bet you didn't know I was such a deep thinker."
"So that's it?"
"That's it," said Peter. "That's my final word. We stay and fight."
64. Sarah descended the stairs to the basement. Grace was at the end of the second row of cots, sitting up, her baby resting in her lap. The woman looked tired, but also relieved. She offered a small smile as Sarah approached.
"He's fussing a little," she said.
Sarah took the baby from her, laid him on the adjacent cot, and unwound the blanket to examine him. A big, healthy boy with curly black hair. His heart was loud and strong.
"We're calling him Carlos, after my father," Grace said.
During the night, Grace had told Sarah the story. 15 years ago, her parents had moved out to the townships, settling in Burnie. But her father had had little luck as a farmer and had been forced to take a job with the telegraph crews, leaving the family alone for months at a time. After he'd been killed in a fall from a pole, Grace and her mother, her 2 older brothers had long since moved on,
had returned to Kerrville to live with relatives. But it had been a hard life, and her mother too had passed, though Grace shared no details. At 17, Grace had gone to work in an illegal saloon. She was vague about her duties, which Sarah didn't want to know, and this was how she'd met Jock. Not an auspicious beginning, although the two were, Grace asserted, very much in love, and when she'd turned up pregnant, Jock had done the honorable thing. Sarah rewrapped the baby and returned him to his mother, assuring her that everything was fine. "He'll complain a bit until your milk comes in. Don't worry, it doesn't mean anything." "What's going to happen to us, Dr. Wilson?" The question seemed too large. "You're going to take care of your son, that's what." "I heard about that woman. They say she's some kind of viral. How could that be?" Sarah was caught off guard. But of course people would be talking. "Maybe she is. I don't know." She put a hand on Grace's shoulder. "Try to rest. The army knows what it's doing." She found Jenny in the storage room, taking inventory of their supplies. Bandages, candles, blankets, water. More boxes had been brought down from the first floor and stacked against the wall. Her daughter Hannah was helping her, a freckled, disarmingly green-eyed girl of 13, with long, coltish legs. "Sweetheart, could your mom and I have a minute? Go see if they need anything upstairs." The girl left them alone. Quickly, Sarah reviewed the plan. "How many people do you think we can fit in here?" she asked. 100 anyway. More if we really stuff them in, I guess. "Let's set up a desk at the front door to count heads. No men get in, only women and children." "What if they try?" "Not our problem. The military will handle it." Sarah examined 4 more patients, the boy with pneumonia, a woman in her 40s who had rushed in with breathing trouble that she feared was a heart attack but was nothing more than panic, 2 little girls, twins who had come down with acute diarrhea and fever in the night, then returned to the first floor in time to see a pair of 5-tons roar up to the entrance. She stepped outside to meet them. "Sarah Wilson?" "That's right." The soldier turned back to the first truck in line. "Okay, start unloading." Moving in pairs, the soldiers began carting sandbags to the entrance. Simultaneously, a pair of Humvees with 50-caliber machine guns attached to their roofs backed up to the building and took flanking positions on both sides of the door. Sarah watched this numbly. The strangeness of all of it was catching up with her. "Can you show me the other entrances?" the sergeant asked. Sarah led him around to the back and side doors. Soldiers arrived with sheets of plywood and began hammering them into the molding. "Those won't keep a drac out," Sarah said. They were standing at the front of the building, where more sheets of plywood were being used to cover the windows. "They're not for the dracs." "Sweet Jesus," she thought. "Do you have a weapon, ma'am?" "This is a hospital, Sergeant. We don't just leave guns lying around." He walked to the first truck and returned with a rifle and pistol. He held them out. "Take your pick." Everything about his offer went against the grain. A hospital still meant something. Then she thought of Kate. "All right, the pistol." She tucked it into her waistband. "You've used one before?" the sergeant said. "I can give you the basics if you want." "That won't be necessary." In the stockade, Alicia was gauging the strength of the chains. The bolt on the wall was negligible. One hard yank should do it. But the shackles were a problem. They were constructed of a hardened alloy of some sort. Probably they had come from Tifty's bunker. The man had made a science of viral containment. So even if she freed herself from the wall, she'd still be as trussed up as a hog for slaughter. The thought of sleep enticed her. Not merely to obliterate time, but to carry her thoughts away. But her dreams, always the same, were nothing she cared to revisit. The brilliantly lit city dissolving to darkness, the happy cries of life within waning, then gone, the pitiless, disappearing door. And then there was the other issue. Alicia wasn't alone. The feeling was subtle, but she could tell Fanning was still there, a sort of low-grade hum in her brain, more tactile than oral, like a breeze pushing over the surface of her mind. It made her feel angry and sick and tired of everything, ready to be done with it all. Get out of my head, goddammit. Haven't I done what you asked? Leave me the hell alone.
The promised food did not appear. Peter had forgotten, or else he'd decided that a hungry Alicia was safer than a full one. It could be a tactic to make her pliable. Food is on the way.
Wait, no, it isn't.
In either event, she was perversely glad. Part of her still hated it. The moment her jaws sank into flesh, hot blood squirting upon her palate, a chorus of revulsion erupted in her head.
What the hell are you doing?
Yet always she drank her fill, until thoroughly disgusted with herself, she sank back on her heels and let the lassitude engulf her. The hours moved sluggishly. At last, the door opened. Surprise! Michael stepped into the room. A small metal cage was pressed against his chest. 5 minutes, Fisher, the guard said, and slammed the door behind him. Michael put the cage on the floor and took a seat on the cot, facing her squarely. In the cage was a brown rabbit.
How'd you get in? Alicia asked.
Oh, they know me pretty well around here.
You bribed them.
Michael seemed pleased. As it happens, a little money changed hands, yes. Even in these troubled times, a man has to think about his family. That, plus nobody else had the stomach to bring you breakfast. He nodded toward the cage. Apparently, the little bundle of fur is somebody's pet. Goes by Otis. Alicia allowed herself a good long look at Michael. The boy she'd known was gone, replaced by a middle-aged man of sinewy hardness, compact and capable. His face had a chiseled look, nothing wasted, though his eyes still possessed their twinkling, busy alertness. A darker aspect lay within them, more knowing. The eyes of experience, of a man who had seen things in his life.
You've changed, Michael.
He shrugged carelessly. This is something I hear a lot.
How have you been keeping yourself?
Oh, you know me. A cockeyed smile. Just keeping the lights burning.
And Lore?
Can't say that worked out.
Sorry to hear it.
You know how it goes. I got the potted plants, she took the house. For the best, really. He angled his head at the floor again, where the caged rabbit was anxiously working its cheeks.
Aren't you going to eat? She wanted to, very badly. The intoxicating scent of warm meat, warm life, the swish and throb of the animal's blood surging through its veins, as if she'd cupped a seashell to her ear. Her anticipation was intense.
It's not a pretty sight, she said. Probably best if I wait.
For several seconds, they just looked at each other.
Thanks for standing up for me last night, Alicia said.
No thanks necessary. Peter was way out of line.
She searched his face. Why don't you hate me, Michael?
Why would I do that?
Everybody else seems to.
I guess I'm not everybody else, then. You could say I don't have a lot of fans in these parts myself.
I hardly believe that.
Oh, trust me. I'm lucky I'm not living down the hall. A smile, unbidden, rose to her lips. It was good to talk to a friend.
Sounds interesting.
That would be one word for it. He placed the tips of his fingers together, a man making a point.
I always knew you were out there, Lish.
Maybe the others gave up on you, but I never did.
Thanks, Circuit. That means something. That means a lot.
He grinned. Now, seeing as it's you, I'll let that nickname slide.
Talk to him, Michael.
I've made my opinion known.
What's he going to do?
He shrugged. What Peter always does, hurl himself at the problem until he bashes his way through it. I love the guy, but he's a bit of an ox.
It won't work this time.
No, it won't. He was watching her intently, though unlike Peter's, his gaze held no suspicion. She was a confidant, a co-conspirator, a trusted part of his world. His eyes, his tone of voice, the manner in which his body occupied space, all radiated an undeniable force.
I've thought a lot about you, Lish.
For a long time, I believed I was in love with you. Who knows? Maybe I still am. I hope that doesn't embarrass you.
Alicia was dumbstruck.
I see from your expression that this comes as a surprise. Just take it as a compliment, which is how it's meant. What I'm saying is that you matter a great deal to me, and you always have. When you appeared last night, I realized something. Do you want to know what that was?
Alicia nodded, still at a loss for words.
I realized I'd been waiting for you all along. Not just waiting. Expecting.
He paused.
Do you remember the last time we saw each other? It was the day you came to visit me in the hospital.
Of course I do.
For the longest time, I wondered, why me? Why did Alicia pick me, of all people, at just that moment? I would have guessed Peter would be the one.
The answer came to me when I thought about something you said. Someday, that boy's going to save our sorry asses.
We were talking about when we were kids.
That's right. But we were talking about a lot more than that.
He leaned forward.
Even then, you knew, Lish.
Maybe not knew.
But you felt it. The shape of things. Just as I did. Just as I do now, sitting here 20 years later talking to you in a jail cell. Now, why is another question?
I don't have an answer to that one, and I've stopped asking. And as for how this is all going to play out, your guess is as good as mine. Given the general direction of the last 24 hours, I'm not especially optimistic.
But either way, I can't do this without you.
The sound of tumblers. The guard appeared in the doorway.
Fisher, I said 5 minutes. You need to get the hell out of here.
Michael reached into his shirt pocket and waved a wad of bills over his shoulder, not even bothering to look as the guard snatched it and skulked away.
God, they're idiots, he sighed. Do they actually think money's going to be worth anything this time tomorrow?
He reached into his pocket again and removed a folded sheet of paper.
Here, take this.
Alicia opened it. A map, hastily sketched in Michael's hand.
When the time comes, follow the Rosenberg Road south. Just beyond the garrison, you'll come to an old farm with a water tank on your left. Take the road after it and follow it straight east, 52 miles.
Alicia looked up from the paper. Something new was in his eyes, a kind of wildness, almost manic. Beneath Michael's controlled exterior, his aura of self-possessing strength, was a man aflame with belief.
Michael, what's at the end of that road?
Alone again. Alicia drifted. So there had been a woman for Michael after all. His ship. His Bergensfjord.
We are the exiles, he had told her in parting. We are the ones who understand the truth and always have. That is our pain in life.
How well he knew her. The rabbit was watching her guardedly. His black eyes, unblinking, shone like drops of ink. In their curved surfaces, Alicia could see the ghost of her face reflected, a shadow self. She realized her cheeks were wet. Why could she not stop crying? She scooted forward to the cage, undid the latch, and reached inside. Soft fur filled her hand. The rabbit made no attempt to escape. He was either tame, a pet, as Michael claimed, or too frightened to react. She lifted the animal free and placed him on her lap.
"It's all right, Otis," she said. "I'm a friend."
And she stayed that way, stroking the soft fur, for a very long time. 65. Footsteps, and the creak of the opening door. Amy opened her eyes.
"Hello, Pim."
The woman halted in the entryway. She was tall, with an oval face and expressive eyes, and wearing a simple cotton dress of blue fabric. Beneath its soft drape, her belly arched with the bulge of her pregnancy.
"I'm glad that you've come back to see me," Amy signed.
A look of deep uncertainty, and Pim stepped to her bedside.
"May I?"
Amy asked. Pim nodded. Amy cupped her palm against the curving cloth. The force within, being so new, exuded a pure feeling of life. If it were a color, it would be the white of summer clouds, but was also full of questions. Who am I? What am I? Is this the world? Am I everything, or just a part?
"Show me the rest," Amy signed.
Pim sat on the bed, facing away. Amy unfastened the buttons of her dress and drew the fabric aside. The stripes on her back, the burns. They were faded, though not erased. Time had given them a ridged and burrowed quality, like roots running under soil. Amy ran the tips of her fingers along their lengths. In the untouched places, Pim's skin was soft, with a pulsing warmth. But the muscles were hard beneath, as if forged with remembered pain. Amy buttoned the dress. Pim swiveled on the mattress to face her.
"I've dreamed about you," Pim sighed. "I feel like I've known you all my life." "And I you."
Pim's eyes were full of inexpressible emotion.
"Even when—"
Amy took her hands to quiet them.
"Yes,"
she replied.
"Even then."
From the pocket of her dress, Pim withdrew a notebook. It was small, but possessed the thickness of stiff parchment paper stitched together.
"I brought you this."
Amy accepted it and opened the covers, which were wrapped in soft hide. Here it was, page after page. The drawings, the words, the island with its five stars.
"Who else has seen this?"
she signed.
"Only you." "Not even Caleb?"
Pim shook her head. A film of tears coated the surface of her eyes. She appeared completely overcome, beyond words.
"How do I know these things?"
Amy closed the notebook.
"I cannot say." "What does it mean?" "I think it means you will live. Your baby will live."
A pause, then,
"Will you help me?"
In the living room, she found paper and a pen. She wrote the note, folded it into thirds, and gave it to Pim, who hurried away. Alone again, Amy went to the bathroom off the hall. Above the wash basin was a small round mirror. The changes that had occurred to her person had been felt rather than observed. She had yet to see herself. She stepped to the mirror. The face she beheld did not seem to be her own, and yet it was also the person she had long felt herself to be. A woman with dark hair, a well-sculpted though not overtly angular face, pale unblemished skin, and deep-set eyes.
Her hair was as short as a boy's, showing the curves of her skull, and bristly to the touch, like the end of a broom. The reflection possessed a disquieting ordinariness. She might have been anyone, just another woman in the crowd. Yet it was within this face, this body, that all her thoughts and perceptions, her sense of self, resided. The urge to reach out and touch the mirror was strong, and she allowed herself to do so. As her finger made contact with the glass, her reflection responding in kind, a shift occurred. "This is you," her mind told her. "This is the one true Amy." It was time. To quiet one's mind, to bring it to a condition of absolute motionlessness. That was the trick. Amy liked to use a lake. This body of water was not imaginary. It was the lake in Oregon where Wolgast, in their first days together at the camp, had taught her to swim. She closed her eyes and willed herself to go there. Gradually, the scene arose in her thoughts. The cusp of night and the first stars punching through a blue-black sky. The wall of shadow where tall pines, rich with fragrance, stood regally along the rocky shore. The water itself, cold and clear and sharp-tasting, and the downy duff of needles carpeting the bottom. In this mental construct, Amy was both the lake and the swimmer in the lake. Ripples moved outward along its surface in accordance with her motions. She took a breath and dove down into an unseen world. When the bottom appeared, she began to move along it with a smooth gliding motion. Far above her, the ripples of her entry dispersed concentrically across the surface. When the last of these disturbances touched their fingers to the shore, and the lake's surface returned to perfect balance, the state she required would be achieved. The ripples touched. The lake stilled. "Can you hear me?" Silence. Then, "Yes, Amy." "I think that I am ready, Anthony. I think I am ready at last." Michael had been waiting at the gate for nearly an hour. Where the hell was Lucius? It was nearly 10:30. They were cutting it close as it was. Men were welding heavy brackets in place to lay iron beams across the gate. More were hammering sheets of galvanized roofing metal to the outside face. If Greer didn't show up soon, they'd be locked inside like everybody else. At last, Greer appeared, striding briskly through the portal from outside. He climbed into the truck and nodded toward the windshield. "Let's go." "She's fooling herself." Greer gave him a look. "Don't go there." Michael turned the engine over, angled his head out the window, and yelled to the foreman of the work crew, "Coming through!" When the man failed to turn around, he leaned on the horn. "Hey, we need to get out!" That got the foreman's attention. He strode up to the driver's window. "The hell you honking at me for? Tell those guys to get out of the way." He spat onto the ground. "Nobody's supposed to go outside. We're working here." "Yeah, well, we're different. Tell them to move or get run over. How would that be?" The man looked like he was about to say something, but stopped himself. He turned back toward the gate. "Okay, clear a path for this guy." "Much obliged," Michael said. The foreman spat again. "It's your funeral, asshole." "Yours too," thought Michael. 66. 16:30 hours. The last of the evacuees were being moved into the dam. The hard boxes were full. The few remaining civilian inductees were awaiting their assignments. There had been a few incidents, some arrests, even a few shots fired. Yet most people saw the sense of what they were being asked to do. Their own lives were on the line. But processing the inductees was taking longer than expected. Long lines, confusion about weapons and who reported to whom, the distribution of equipment and delegation of duties. Peter and Apgar were trying to assemble an army in half a day. Some barely knew how to hold a gun, much less load and fire it. Ammo was at a premium, but a target range had been set up in the square, using sandbags as a backstop. A crash course for the uninitiated. 3 shots, good or bad, and off they went to the wall. Just a few weapons remained, pistols only. The rifles were gone, except for a few that would be held in reserve. Tempers were short. Everyone had been standing in the hot sun for hours. Peter was positioned to the side of the processing desk with Apgar, watching the last few men come through. Hollis was checking off names. A man approached the desk, 40s, lean in the manner of someone to whom life had not been kind, with a high domed forehead and old acne scars on his cheeks. A hunting rifle hung from his shoulder. It took Peter a moment to recognize him. Jock, isn't it? The man nodded, somewhat sheepishly, Peter thought. 20 years gone by, yet Peter could tell that the memory of that day on the roof still affected him. I don't think I ever really thanked you, Mr. President. Apgar glanced at Peter. What did you do? Jock said, he saved my life is what he did. Then, to Peter, I've never forgotten it. Voted for you both times. What became of you? No more roofs, I'll bet. Jock shrugged. His regular life, like everyone's, was receding into the past. Worked as a mechanic, mostly. Just got married, too. My wife had a baby last night. Peter remembered Sarah's story. He gestured toward Jock's rifle, a lever-action 30-30. Let's see your weapon. Jock handed it over. The action was jerky, the trigger like mush, the glass of the scope gouged and pitted. When was the last time you fired this? Never. Got it from my dad years ago. Hollis looked up. We don't have any 30-30. How many rounds do you have for this? Peter asked Jock. The man held out his open palm, showing 4 cartridges, old as the hills. This thing is worthless. Hollis, get this man a proper rifle. The gun was produced. One of Tifty's M16s, fresh and gleaming. A wedding present, Peter said, passing it off to Jock. Report to the range. They'll get you ammo and show you how to use it. The man looked up, blindsided. His face was full of gratitude. No one had ever given him such a present. Thank you, sir. A crisp nod, and he moved away. Okay, what was that about? Apgar asked. Peter's eyes followed Jock as he made his way to the range. For luck, he said. In the orphanage, the last of the women and children were descending into the shelter. It had been decided that only women with children under 5 would be allowed to accompany their offspring. There had been many tearful scenes of separation, agonizing and awful. Quite a few mothers claimed their children were younger than they obviously were. In those instances that seemed close, or close enough, Caleb let them through. He simply didn't have the heart to say no. Caleb worried about Pim. The shelter was rapidly filling. At last she arrived, explaining that the children had spent the morning at Kate and Bill's house. For Pim, a painful pilgrimage, Kate's ghost everywhere. But a helpful distraction for the girls. A few hours in familiar rooms, playing with familiar toys. They'd bounced on their old beds for 30 minutes, Pim said. And yet, something was off. Caleb sensed the presence of words unsaid. They were standing by the open hatch. One of the sisters, positioned on the platform below, reached up to assist the children, first Theo, then the girls. As Pim's turn came, Caleb took her by the elbow. What is it? She hesitated. Yes, something was there. Pim? A flicker of uncertainty in her eyes. Then she composed herself. I love you. Be careful. Caleb let the matter rest. Now was not the time. the hatch standing open, everyone waiting. Sister Peg was observing from the side. Caleb had already broached the question of whether or not Sister Peg would be joining the children underground. "Lieutenant," she'd said with a reproachful look, "I'm 81 years old." Caleb hugged his wife and helped her down. As her hands gripped the top rung, she raised her eyes for a last look. A cold weight dropped inside him. She was his life. "Keep our babies safe," he signed. More children came through. Then suddenly, the shelter was full. From outside the building, a cry went up, followed by a voice from a megaphone, ordering the crowd to disperse. Colonel Henneman strode into the hall. "Jackson, I'm putting you in charge here." It was the last thing Caleb wanted. "I'd be more use on the wall, sir. This isn't a debate." Caleb felt the presence of an unseen hand. "Does my father have something to do with this?" Henneman ignored the question. "We'll need men on the roof and the perimeter and two squads inside. Are we clear? Nobody else gets inside. How you accomplish that is up to you." Dire words. Also inevitable. People would do anything to survive. 67. Michael and Greer picked up the first survivors north of Rosenberg, a group of three soldiers, stunned, starving, their carbines and pistols drained. The virals had attacked the barracks 2 nights ago, they said, tearing through the place like a tornado, destroying everything, vehicles and equipment, the generator and radio, ripping the roofs off the Quonsets like they were opening tins of meat. There were others. A woman, one of Dunk's girls, with black hair streaked white, walking barefoot along the roadway with her tippy shoes dangling from her fingertips and a story about hiding in a pump house. A pair of men from one of the telegraph crews. An oiler named Winch. Michael recalled him from the old days, sitting cross-legged by the side of the road, carving meaningless shapes in the ground with a 6-inch knife and babbling incoherently. His face was chalky with dust. His coveralls black with dried blood, though it was not his own. All took their places in the back of the truck in stunned silence, not even asking where they were going. "These are the luckiest people on the planet," Michael said, "and they don't even know it." Greer watched the landscape flow past, dry scrub yielding to the dense tangle of the coastal shelf. The intensity of the last 24 hours had kept the pain at bay. But now, in the unstructured silence of his thoughts, it roared back. An omnipresent, low-grade urge to vomit tossed his gut. His saliva was thick and brassy-tasting. His bladder pulsed with unexpressed fullness, febrile and enormous. When they'd stopped to pick up the woman, Greer had stepped into the scrub with the hope of passing water. But all he'd managed to produce was a pathetic crimson-tinted trickle. South of Rosenberg, they swung east toward the ship channel. Muddy water sprayed up behind them. Each bang of the truck's carriage on the gullied roadway threw fresh punches of pain. Greer wanted a drink of water very badly, if only to clear the taste in his mouth. But when Michael drew his canteen from under his seat, took a long pull and offered it to him, all the while staring out the windshield, Greer waved it off. From Michael, a sideways glance. "You're sure?" And for that moment the man seemed to know something, or at least suspect. But when Greer said nothing, Michael wedged the canteen between his knees and capped it with a shrug. The air in the truck changed, and then the sky. They were approaching the channel.
"For fuck's sakes, I only just came from here," said the woman.
5 more miles and the causeway appeared. Patch and his men were waiting at the bottleneck. Barriers of razor wire had been laid across it. As the truck drew to a halt, Patch stepped up to the driver's window.
"Didn't expect you back so soon."
"What has Laura told you?" Michael asked.
"Just the bad parts. No sign of them here, though."
Then glancing into the back of the vehicle,
"I see you've brought some friends."
"Where is she?"
"The ship, I guess.
Rand says she's driving everybody crazy down there.
Michael turned toward their passengers. You three, he said to the soldiers, get out. They were looking around with bewilderment.
What do you want us to do?
One asked. The highest ranking among them, a corporal with eyes empty as a cow's and the soft, baby-fatted face of a 15-year-old.
I don't know, Michael said dryly. Be soldiers? Shoot at things?
I told you we haven't got any ammo.
Patch? The man nodded. I'll fix them up. This is Patch, Michael said to the three. He's your new CO. They looked blankly at one another.
Aren't you guys like criminals? The one said.
Right now, do you honestly give a damn?
Come on now, Patch cut in. Be good fellows and do like the man says. Looking askance at one another, the soldiers disembarked. Once Patch and the others had pulled the barrier aside, Michael gunned the engine and roared down the causeway. Rand met them at the shed, shirtless and sweating, a greasy rag knotted around his head. What's our status? Michael asked, stepping down. Have you flooded the dock?
There's a problem. Lore found another bad section. There are soft spots all through it.
Where?
Starboard bow.
Fuck. Michael gestured toward their remaining passengers, who were standing in a group, staring with befuddlement. Figure out what to do with these people.
Where'd you get them?
Found them on the way.
Isn't that Winch? Rand asked.
The man was muttering into his collar.
What the hell happened to him?
Whatever it was. It wasn't nice, Michael answered. Rand's eyes darkened.
Is it true about the townships? That they're all gone?
Michael nodded.
Yeah.
Looks like we're it. Greer interrupted. Michael, I think we need to take extra men up to the causeway. It'll be dark in a few hours.
Rand, how about it?
I guess we can spare a few.
Lombardi and those other guys.
You two, Rand said to the telegraph men, come with me. And you, he said to the woman, what can you do?
She arched her eyebrows.
Besides that, I mean,
she thought for a moment.
Cook a little?
A little's better than what we've got. You're hired.
Michael strode down the ramp to the ship. A crane with a sling had been moved into place on the dock near the bow, where six men in bosun's chairs hung over the side. At the far end of the weir, men in welding masks and heavy gloves were using circular saws to cut the replacement from a larger plate, sparks jetting from their blades. Lore, standing at the rail, saw him and came down.
Sorry, Michael.
She was practically yelling to make herself heard over the whine of the saws.
The timing isn't great, I know.
What the hell, Lore? Did you want her to sink? Because she would have. I'm not the one who missed it. You should be thanking me.
This was more than a delay. It was a catastrophe. Until the hull was tight, they couldn't flood the dock. Until they flooded the dock, they couldn't fire the engines. Just flooding the dock would take an additional 6 hours.
How long do you figure to replace it? He asked.
To cut the plates, pull out the old ones, lower them into place, rivet and weld. I'd say 16 hours minimum.
There was no reason to question her. It wasn't something that could be rushed. He turned on his heels and headed down the dock.
Where are you going? Lore called after him.
To cut some fucking steel.
68. The time was 17:30. The sun would set in 3 hours. For the moment, Peter had done all he could. He was well past the need to sleep, but wanted a moment to collect himself. He thought of Jock as he walked to the house. He had no particular allegiance to the man. He had been a callow and obnoxious kid who had nearly gotten Peter killed. The rifle was probably wasted on him. But Peter recognized that day on the roof as a turning point, and he believed in second chances. The security detail was gone. Peter darted up the stairs and raced into the house.
Amy,
he called. A silence, then, in here. She was sitting on the bed, facing the door, hands folded neatly in her lap.
Are you all right?
He asked. She looked up. Her face changed. She gave him a melancholy smile. A peculiar quiet took the room. Not merely an absence of sound, but something deeper, more fraught.
Yes, I'm fine.
She patted the mattress.
Come sit with me.
He took a place beside her. What is it? What's wrong? She took his hand, not looking at him. He sensed she was on the verge of some announcement.
When I was in the water, I went someplace, she said. At least, my mind did. I'm not sure I can explain this right. I was so happy there.
He realized what she was saying. The farmstead. Her eyes found his.
I've been there too.
Strangely, he felt no surprise. The words had been waiting to be said.
I was playing the piano.
Yes.
And we were together.
Yes, we were. Just the two of us.
How good to say it, to speak the words, to know that he was not alone with his dreams after all, that there was some reality to it, though he could not know what that reality was, only that it existed. He existed. Amy existed. The farmstead, and their happiness in that place, existed.
You asked me this morning why I came to you in Iowa, Amy said.
I didn't tell you the truth. Or at least, not all of it.
Peter waited.
When you change, you get to keep one thing, one memory, whatever was closest to your heart, from all your life, just the one.
She looked up.
What I wanted to keep was you.
She was crying, just a little, small jeweled tears that hung suspended on the tips of her lashes, like drops of dew upon leaves.
Peter, will you do something for me?
He nodded.
Please kiss me.
He did. He did not so much kiss her as fall into the world of her.
Time slowed, stopped, moved in an unhurried circle around them, like waves around a pier.
He felt at peace. His senses were soaring. His mind was in two places, this world and also the other. The world of the farmstead, a place beyond space, beyond time, where only the two of them resided. They parted. Their faces were inches apart. Amy cupped his cheek, her eyes locked on his.
I'm sorry, Peter.
The remark was strange. Her gaze deepened.
I know what you're planning to do, she said. You wouldn't survive it.
Something came undone inside him, all strength drained from his body. He tried to speak, but couldn't.
You're tired, Amy said.
She caught him as he fell. Amy laid him on the bed. In the outer room, she pulled her frock over her head and replaced it with the clothing that Greer had fetched for her. Heavy canvas pants with pockets, leather boots, a tan shirt, the sleeves torn away, with the insignia of the expeditionary on the shoulders. They possessed a warm, human odor, a smell of work, of life. Whoever had owned these articles was small. The fit was nearly perfect. On the back porch, the soldiers slept soundly, like babies, hands tucked under their cheeks, lost to all cares. Amy gently relieved one of his pistol and tucked it into her trousers, against her spine. A deep quiet held the street, everyone in hiding, bracing for the storm. As Amy made her way toward the center of town, soldiers began to take notice. Yet none spoke to her. Their minds were elsewhere. What did one woman matter?
The exterior of the stockade was unguarded. Amy strode purposefully to the door and stepped inside. She counted three men. Behind the counter, the officer in charge glanced up.
Help you, soldier?
The sound of tumblers. Alicia raised her eyes. Amy? Hello, sister. Alicia looked past her, but saw no one. Amy was alone. What are you doing here? She asked. Amy was unlocking the shackles. She handed Alicia her goggles. I'll explain on the way. In the outer room, the guards lay asleep on the floor. Following Greer's directions, Amy and Alicia made their way via back streets and trash-strewn alleys into H-Town. Soon the southern wall rose into view. Amy entered a small house, little more than a hut. There was no furniture at all. In the main room, she drew a threadbare rug aside to reveal a hatch with a ladder. One of the trades, stash houses, Amy explained, though Alicia had already figured that out. They descended into a cool, damp space that smelled of rotten fruit. There, Amy said, pointing. The shelves, stocked with liquor, pulled away to reveal a tunnel. At the far end, they came to another ladder and 10 feet up, a metal hatch set into concrete. Amy turned the ring and pushed. They were outside the city, 100 yards outside the wall in a copse of trees. Soldier and a second horse were tied up, obliviously grazing. As Alicia climbed free of the hatch, Soldier raised his head. Ah, there you are. I was beginning to wonder. Her sword and bandoliers were hanging from the saddle. Alicia strapped on her blades while Amy covered the hatch with brush. You should be the one to ride him, Alicia said. She was also holding out the sword. Amy considered this. All right, she said. She angled the sword over her shoulders and swung up onto Soldier's back. Alicia mounted the second horse, a dark bay stallion, quite young but with a fierce look to him. It was late afternoon, the sun harsh and white. They rode away. The dream of the farmstead was different. Peter was lying in bed. The room was full of moonlight, making the walls seem to glow. The sheets were cold. It was this coldness that had aroused him. He had a sense of having slept a long time. Amy's side of the bed was empty. He called her name. His voice sounded weak in the darkness, barely a presence. He rose and went to the window. Amy was standing in the yard, facing away from the house. Her posture meant something. Panic surged in his heart. She began to walk, away from the house. Away from him and the life they had known, her figure silhouetted by the moonlight, growing smaller. Peter could neither move nor cry out. He felt as if his soul were being wrenched from his body. Don't leave me, Amy. He awoke with a start. His heart was pounding, his body glazed with sweat. Apgar's face swam into focus. Mr. President, something has happened. He didn't have to say the rest. Peter knew at once. Amy was gone. 9. The Trap. Blood ran in torrents, drenched was all the earth, as Trojans and their alien helpers died. Here were men lying quelled by bitter death, all up and down the city in their blood. Quintus Smyrnaeus, The Fall of Troy. 69. The saws had silenced. The steel had been cut. On the ship's starboard flank, a gaping hole revealed the hidden decks and passageways within. The sun was receding, sparkling over the channel's waters. The spotlights had been lit. Rand was operating the crane. From the floor of the dock, Michael watched the first plate descending in its cradle. Voices volleyed through the dock, more from up on deck, where Lore commanded. The required height was achieved. Men scurried over the surface, hammers and pneumatic guns swaying from their belts. Others guided the plate from inside. With a clang, the huge steel sheet made contact. Michael ascended the stairs and crossed the gangway to the deck.
"So far, so good," Lore said.
They were improbably on schedule. The passing hours were like a funnel, drawing them down to a single moment. Every decision was binding. There would be no second chances. Lore went to the rail and yelled down a barrage of orders, trying to make her voice heard over the roar of the generators and the whine of the guns. Michael moved beside her. The first plate lay flush against the side. They had 6 more to go.
"Want to know how they did it?"
Lore looked at him strangely. "How the passengers killed themselves." He had not meant to raise the subject. It seemed to have arisen of its own accord. One more secret he wanted to be rid of.
"Okay."
They'd saved some fuel. Not much, but enough. They sealed the doors and rerouted the engine's exhaust back into the ship's ventilation. It would have been like falling asleep. Lore's face showed no expression. Then, with a small nod,
"I'm glad you said something."
"Maybe I shouldn't have."
"Don't apologize."
He realized why he had told her. If it came to that, they could do the same thing.
70. The light was leaving them. Runners had begun to move. From the command post on the catwalk, Peter felt with cold clarity the thinness of their defense. A 6-mile perimeter, men without training, an enemy like no other, lacking all fear. Though Apgar said nothing on the subject, Peter could read the man's thoughts. Maybe Amy had gone with Alicia to give herself up. Maybe the Drax wouldn't come after all. Maybe they would anyway. Maybe that was the point. He remembered his dream. The image of Amy in the moonlight walking away, not looking back. All that kept him going was the certainty of what lay ahead in the next few hours. He had a role to play, and he would play it. Chase arrived on the platform. Peter almost didn't recognize his chief of staff. The man was dressed in an officer's uniform, though the insignia had been removed, cut away roughly as if in a hurry, perhaps out of respect. He was toting a rifle, trying to seem a certain way with it. The gun looked like it had been hanging over a fireplace for years. Peter was about to say something, then stopped himself. Apgar raised a skeptical eyebrow, but that was the extent of it.
"Where's Olivia?" Peter asked finally.
"In the president's heart box."
Chase seemed uncertain.
"I hope that's all right."
The 3 men listened as the stations called in. All stood ready, braced for attack. The shadows lengthened over the valley. It was a beautiful evening in summer, the clouds ripening with color.
71.
Amy did not have to know the place. The place, she knew, would come to her. They galloped away from the sun, the ground flying beneath them. Dust rose in a gritty cloud. Clods of dirt flew up from the horse's hooves. A certain feeling built within her. It magnified with every mile, like a radio signal growing stronger, calling them forward. Soldier's gait was powerful and smooth.
"You have taken wonderful care of our friend," Amy told him. "How brave you are, how strong. You will always be remembered. Green fields await you. You will spend a noble eternity among your kind."
Soldier's gallop faded to a walk. They brought their horses to a halt and dismounted. The rich foam of his efforts boiled from Soldier's mouth. His dark flanks flashed with sweat.
"Here," Amy said.
Alicia nodded, but said nothing. Amy detected within her friend an edge of fear. She stepped away and stood in silence, waiting. The wind moved by her ears, through her hair, then faded to nothing. All seemed frozen, sealed in a great calm, The day's last minutes ticked away. On the ground before her, her shadow stretched.